Good morning, everyone. Everyone's had a good night of rest, hopefully. And I know I did. And we're ready for another day. We're going to look at the last part of this series that has to do with the events at the time of the end. And it has been designated by various titles. An article by Brother Grocott, which appeared in the Brien magazine several times, titled The Last Terrible 40 Years, is one title by which it has been called. We've also studied it under the topic of the March of the Rainbowed Angel, which has to do with, it's a reference to Christ and the saints. Comes from Revelations 10, verse 1. And we've also studied this as a part of God's great plan with His earth and the things that He will bring about in it. And I know that there are some of you who have not been with us from the beginning of this presentation. So just to recap where we've been, we have talked about this in reference to the time that these things will occur. We've talked about it in reference to the place where it will happen, from which it will emanate. We know that is the heart of God's plan exists in the land of Israel, a little spot in the world, in the Fertile Crescent. We look at the why, which is probably one of the most important things having to do with this. As we run through this series, we keep referring back to it. And we know that that, of course, as the Bible reveals, is to give glory to Yahweh and to His holy name, that all nations of the earth and all people of the earth may see and reference this as a part of His plan and part of what gives glory to His name. It is the sole reason for His creation. It is the sole reason why we exist. Salvation, as Brother Thomas had said, and to paraphrase him, is not about us. Salvation is about giving glory to God's name. And we looked at the players involved in this. The King of the North, the King of the South, Israel, Christ and the saints. And last night, we began considering the how. And we distributed the handouts giving the sequence of events that relate to this part of the topic, the how. And we'll continue that and wind up with what does it mean to us this morning. So this is where we left off at number 17 on your handout, where the conquering of all lands that were promised to Abraham from the Nile to the Euphrates was realized. It was the completion, the regeneration and disciplining of Israel, Egypt and Assyria, which was the original entire area of Eden, the Garden of God. And all that being done, we see it now restored to its former condition of peace and beauty. So that part of the land has been transformed. As Brother Grocott said, in the last terrible 40 years, Christ can go nowhere but what He transforms and purifies the area in which He goes and conquers the area and the people. So this part of the world at this point of time, as we come to that place in the chart of number 17, has realized that transformation, but there is still a lot of work to be done. If we go back to the chart, I'm looking at the full page, but I didn't bother to hand out because you've got it in two sheets, a little larger print. But we're now in the last part of it. And that has to do with the construction of the temple beginning. Now, this A lot of these things we deal with in a sequence, but you have to remember, a lot of them are being carried on. They're ongoing as a lot of these other things are happening. There are overlaps taking place here, and that's why it's a little bit hard to do it on a presentation like this, because we have to deal with each thing. And that's why you saw there was a remnant of Israel brought out from Egypt, but that doesn't mean that that's all there is to do with Egypt and with the purifying of Israel. There is still a further part of that that we'll study today. And that has to do with the proclamation of the everlasting gospel, the regathering of the 10 tribes, the work of Elijah, the grinding of the image to powder, and then, you know, the rallying of Judah and the armies of Judah moving north, the second Exodus. So all of that will be covered today in greater detail. But remember that there's overlaps happening here. So if it seems like sometimes we're repeating ourselves, it's because we're going back and showing again where we're at in that sequence, or in that particular event, such as the regathering of the tribes. So number 18, construction of the temple. This is a big topic by itself, and we're just going to look at some highlights having to do with this. I'm just going to back up there, I think. No, I did get it right here. Okay, sorry about that. I thought I was in a different place than I was, but I'm doing okay. We're on this topic about where we're just going to take a look back and look at the tabernacle, the first temple, and the second temple, and then the third temple. There's a history, and it goes in a sequence, starting with Moses, going to Solomon, then to Herod in the time of Christ, and finally the third temple, as we will attempt to deal with here. We know what happened to the past temples. They were destroyed. They were plundered, due very much to the disobedience of the nation of Israel. And the third temple, Jesus predicted, he says, "See ye not all these things," as his disciples showed him with some pride, no doubt, the huge building of this third temple. He says, "I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." They must have been awestruck by that statement. But it came to pass. All that remains today is a part of a foundation wall that was built for the second temple compound. It was called the Western Wall. Quoting again from our Savior, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. And verily I say unto you, ye shall not see me until the time come when ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." A reference here to the divine timeline. God does have a timeline, and it will be fulfilled. It will come to pass. And when these things have been accomplished, we know that our Savior will return. Ezekiel saw through visions an immense building. And we feel the psalmist had reference to this somewhat. He says, "Walk about Zion, go all around her, count her towers, mark well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. For this is God, our God, forever and ever. He will be our guide even to death." Again, the glory of Yahweh referenced. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 2, he says, "In the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain, by which was as the frame of a city on the south. A high mountain, possibly referencing Mount Zion, or it could have referenced Moriah. But either way, it's very close. And this is a drawing by Brother Sully in his book, The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy. And he gives forth his suggestion there, which is based on Scripture as much as possibly can be, and references as a line drawn through. And this follows very much the fault line that we looked at last night. It follows through Mount of Olives and right through the Temple Mount. And he felt that the temple would be built pretty much in reference to that line, because we know that when the earthquake will occur, this will be split, and this will, all the elevations and the valleys will become a plain in a very level surface. Mount Moriah, as it looks today, we see in the bottom corner. We looked at this last night, the site preparation of this and how the elevations will be changed. Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half toward the south. Now, where the temple is right up in here, and there's two streams you see running to the north and to the south. And where this scene is located, where the arrow is, here is the elevation of Masada, and that is located right just a little south of En Gedi. We'll look at this a little closer later. In fact, right here. This is a map, again, of the illustration we just looked at earlier. And this shows the holy oblation, the square, the 25,000 reeds, and the holy portion of the sons of Zadok, the house of prayer, Yehovah Sham, the city, what is called the profane city, very, very close to Masada. Those of us who were on Masada a little over a year ago could almost see the northeast corner of the what is projected to be the city of the future, south of the house of prayer. Yehovah Shom, if we pronounce it according to the Hebrew. These dimensions that are given describe a city of over 10 miles square, with its suburbs about 1,000 yards wide, extending to the full width of the portion set apart for the city. The unique character of the city is indicated by the specified use of the residue, this co-residue of the city portion, by an allocation of services which must be rendered to it by all the tribes of Israel. Thus we read, "And the residue in length over against the oblation of the holy portion shall be 10,000 eastward, 10,000 westward. It shall be over against the oblation of the holy portion, and the increase thereof shall be for food unto them that serve the city. They that serve the city shall serve it out of all the tribes of Israel." The words Yahweh Shammah or Yehovah Shom may be literally translated "the Lord thither." And if we look at Strong's, the Lord is there references more there in terms of time, more as rather than to place. The time has come. Rendering in harmony with the above premises, indicating that those who worship in the temple go up from this city. The city may be likened to a huge garden city hotel in which are received all those who visit the temple. Here the people who come from all parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of the greater than Solomon and to pay their vows unto the Most High would be entertained. They'd be put up here, and this would be their gathering place. So this is something to keep in mind as we think about this. This is all a part of what's going to be happening during that period that we call the last terrible 40 years, is the construction of these things. We just have the little squares on the map here showing where this comes from. This is the, on this map, it would occupy this portion. And if we go to the map of the tribal allotments, the square represents again the cutout of the enlargement of that this comes from. Of what is it to be built? Right now, in all construction, all new construction of Jerusalem, there's a mandatory use of a very beautiful marble-like substance called Jerusalem stone. And it just so happens that the city of Jerusalem sits on top of a tremendous quarry of this stone. The whole mountain on which it sits is comprised of Jerusalem stone. Again, a very beautiful marble-like substance, and depending on where it, how it's cut and where it's mined, it's got different colors and hues and patterns. Very beautiful. And there's some examples here from the old and the new of the use of that stone, both in residential and commercial buildings there. We remember that this mountain is to be dissected, as it were, by the earthquake. And so that will definitely expose this stone for the builders like nothing else would. Why is it to be built? It is to be built to give God glory. It is to be the place where the law goes forth from Jerusalem. And it comes at the end of the kingdoms of men when everything else is destroyed. Let's just take a little short guided tour. And we'll try to reference this to sizes of football fields so we get some idea. He measured the east side 500 reeds, the north side 500 reeds, the south side 500 reeds. He turned to the west and measured 500 reeds as the measuring reed. So how does that work out? Well, we do a little interpretation here, and using the measurements that Brother Sully has worked out, he used the 2-foot cubit and a reed equaling 12 feet. So the dimensions of that building from corner to corner as you go around the square are 6,000 feet wide and 6,000 feet long, a little over a mile square. The total area of that works out to 36 million square feet. 36 million. The effective area for worshipers, we have to remember that there's a great mountain in the middle, and this is the most holy where the worshipers do not go. So the effective area around the outside of that for worshipers is approximately 20 million square feet. And the capacity of that, allowing a fair bit of room for each individual, would work out to about 1.25 million worshippers at any given time could be in that square. The frequency of the visit is dictated in Zechariah 14:16. Everyone shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So the capacity, assuming a 24-hour duration, a 24-hour stay in that location, and we have no, we're just, taking this out of a hat, as it were. We have no indication how long that each visitor will stay, but say it was an average of 24 hours, it would give a capacity of 1.25 million worshipers per day or 450 million per year to go through. Now, if that were worked out to, say, 3 hours duration, and it could be anywhere in between or more or less, but just using a 3-hour duration per worshiper, then that would skyrocket to 10 million worshipers per day or 3.6 billion per year. So does it have enough capacity? I think so. The next part of this that we just want to look at briefly is he talks about a wall on the outside of the house round about. He measured the breadth, one reed 12 feet, the other, and the height 12 feet. So what he's referencing here is this little stubby, you would call a stubby wall compared to the height of the rest of the building. Just a little area there. And that is depicted on the other graph here by this little line that goes right along all the way around, that little line. That's the wall. Now, to build that by today's standards, it would take 11,000 truckloads of concrete to build that little wall. There would be enough to put concrete floors in 10,000 homes or lay 16 miles of 36 foot wide by 1 foot thick concrete highway just to build this little wall. And it's called little relative to the size of the rest of the building. And I use this just to get some indication of the amount of material that would have to be gathered and put into place for the entire structure, if it takes that much just to build that little wall. We look first at the, or we look next, I should say, at the gate buildings. These are 96 feet wide, and they are 120 feet high. This one is, we're looking at it as we're, as it were, as though we were suspended above it, looking straight down. And this one, we're looking at it as though we were in front of it. And by the way, this is this little wall here. You see it going right here all the way around. That's the little wall. And I put a little circle in the overall picture here to indicate what it is we're looking at. You know, we're looking as we're looking down on this part here, or we're looking in front of this building as it would exist over here, or anywhere else around the building. Perhaps before we go any further, we're in the right place just to take a look at something else here that I've got. And we just got a little virtual. I'll just see if I can bring this up full screen for you. Take a little tour. And this was something I got off the internet several years ago. Now, this would be the little wall that he's just walking up to right here. That's that little wall. And then he goes up the steps, through the doors, and into the interior of the building. And then those doors swing, and he comes, we're now in the interior, he comes, goes around, and enters a lift, an elevator. And then this is a scene as it were walking down the outer court towards one of the end towers. And where we were looking, where we were walking down was in that little movie clip, was as though we were walking down between these two walls. They're 200 feet wide. And as we said, 6,000 feet long. This is the inner court gate building and the outer court gate building. This would be the exterior of the temple. Looking at it this way, would be the exterior. So you come, go up the steps, go inside, and then through here would go to the inner court. Let's just take a brief consideration of the four corner courts, these huge towers. This is the place where the priests shall boil the trespass offering and the sin offering, and where they shall bake the grain offering. These are the kitchens where the ministers of the temple shall boil the sacrifices of the people. Now in these buildings, they're 540 feet high and 360 feet square. There are five levels, each level large enough to accommodate five football fields. Get the idea. Each level accommodate five football fields, so altogether you'd have enough there for 25 football fields in one building. And with all four buildings, you'd have enough for 100 football fields. This gives us a bit of a cutaway of the vista of the inner, the outer and inner courts. This being the outer court, where we saw the scene walking down it towards the tower building. Then you can go through this and into the separate place, which is allotted for the priests to carry forward the sacrifices of the people into the circular building, which is this one, the inner circular temple. The inner temple and the porches of the court, the entrance spaces and the arabesques, the galleries and three stories before the entrance spaces are creepers even to the covered openings. And it was made with cherubim and columns, so that a column was between a cherub and a cherub. And every cherub had two faces, so that the face of a man was toward the column on the one side, and the face of a young lion toward the column on the other side. So here we have the inner temple, the porches of the court, the arabesques, and this will give us a bit of an idea what is being talked about here. There's the creepers, the cherubim, the palm trees or columns, and the covered opening or the wall, which here is 200 feet high, and this is all covered by ribbed ceilings on the interior. Floor plan, as though we were looking down on it, is 200 feet across. It's 40 feet wide in the passageway. This is the most holy. We see the gradual arc here of the curve. There are three great halls, because we're looking at three levels. There's 30 great halls in each section, each one of these being 200 by 500. Now that means that each is the size of four football fields. The walls here are 10 feet thick and 140 feet high. And this gives us a cross section from the endways. Then we come to the center part, the most holy, and the altar of sacrifice. And this is showing about a reference here of 600 feet high, so the elevation of that would possibly be that, perhaps a little higher. The size of the altar is given, called the Lion of God, is 144 feet square. To the outside of the smaller court, the wall here would be 168 feet square. To the outside of the lower court is 186 feet square. The total area of this altar is equal to 1.5 football fields, just as an altar for sacrifice. Brother Sully suggested that there is a conveyor of sacrifices going up from the east side, shown here. And there is a stream of living water flowing out from under the altar that flows out toward the Dead Sea and towards the Mediterranean, the Hinder Sea and the Former Sea. And that is to purify the water of the Dead Sea and form a passageway for trade and commerce. So that's just a brief overview of this great immense structure that is to be commenced here at number 18 on our chart. So we go forward from there, and we look then, the next thing is the proclamation of the everlasting gospel. It goes out. There's a period, a respite, it appears, and this proclamation goes out to all those who are yet prepared to submit to Christ and his rule. The next step is the regathering of the 10 tribes. And this begins with the work of Elijah. And it would appear that this work of Elijah works with the 10 tribes and uses the influence that is given to him and the power that is given to him to spread the word, the message throughout the world to all the tribes of Israel living wherever they may be living in the world, and to gather them back through a period of great tribulation to a purification and acceptance of Christ. Chapter 21 talks about the grinding of the image to powder, and we looked at the image being defeated, that Christ and the saints emerged victorious, but it appears that there's a reference here to a final grinding to powder of any remnants of that might exist, and we have it here in kind of a faded representation. It's not in its glory, but there's possibly still remnants of it that do exist, and there's a period of time when that is ground to powder. But there is something else that emerges in its place, or that is still left as a part of it, and that is the Confederacy of the Mother of Harlots. And this is where the rest of the work of Christ and the saints will be focused on in terms of the resistance and the confrontation that will have to be carried forward. Revelation speaks of this. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit on a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. This is what Brother Jerry had spoken to us about in his series yesterday, about the apostasy of the truth and where it has come from and where it has gone and where it has ended up. And this is speaking about that. The mother, Babylon the great mother church, and the harlots, all the other Protestant churches that have sprung and been spawned off of her. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. The woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Then the next part we look at is the rallying of Judah, the army formed and prepared by Christ, it would appear, to carry war forth to the nations. And they are instrumental also in freeing their brethren from, and through the work and assistance. And this is a little bit of what I'm speaking about. There's overlap going on here. The work of Elijah is going on, and it would appear that there's some assistance given by the armies of Judah as they move out and spread into the other parts of the world. And there is a second exodus that comes forward from that. And we've tried to depict in a graphic way here how this might look. The armies of Judah moved north to free the Jews in other parts of the world. And then this does take place. And remember the blue representing the nation and tribes of Israel. They're brought back, it would appear, into the area of Egypt. And from thence are brought forward through a second exodus. And perhaps all of this whole operation could be termed a second exodus, not just a little bit here coming forth from Egypt, but the whole operation of bringing them out and bringing them through Egypt and being baptized in the waters just as they were, their brethren were in days of old. So we see the blue situated there and then brought forth into the Eden, the Garden of God, the headquarters of this tremendous operation under the rainbowed angel. You come to it at the same time. Again, this is not next to it, but as close to it as we can get, because all the time that is going on, there's this 30 years of papal resistance to the rule of what it regards as Antichrist. The people of the earth do not accept Christ readily. They resist it. And they feel that Christ is the Antichrist. Christ and the saints are the Antichrist. And that is why they resist it. They've been tricked by the fraud that is being perpetrated upon them by so-called religion of today. And we see some examples of this. This is from a typical Protestant website. The abomination of desolation is an event or action perpetrated by the future Antichrist. When the Antichrist shall walk into the newly built last days temple of Jerusalem and takes a seat upon the mercy seat inside the Holy of Holies, note this wording, and proclaims to the world that he is God Almighty. This event is probably perpetrated by the future Antichrist. So will they be tricked? Absolutely. They will be fooled and dumbfounded by this kind of fraud that has gone forward from things like the internet and from the pulpit. This event is probably perpetrated by the future Antichrist, they say, at the midpoint of the seven-year covenant which he arranges with Israel, granting Israel permission to rebuild their temple on the Temple Mount. So when they see these things happening, what will they be thinking? This is the Antichrist. Let's get rid of him. And this is from the Catholic Encyclopedia. The fathers of the church speculated on the Antichrist in various ways. They showed the temple to be the Jewish temple rebuilt by Antichrist in Jerusalem. Rather than the Bishop of Rome, the early fathers identified Antichrist as a government official, a king coming to power in the ruins of the Roman Empire. He would probably be Jewish, possibly from the tribe of Dan. He would then seduce many of the Jewish people by attempting to fulfill the political aspirations they held for the Messiah. It's interesting. So, there will this 30 years papal resistance will come out of that. Judah as Christ's bow and Israel as Christ's battle axe take Europe, papal and other leaders. This is the, you might call, the second phase of the Armageddon battle. The first phase being the defeat of the power of the north, the image of Nebuchadnezzar standing in its place at the time of the end. That would have been the first phase. But as we said, it's not over. There's still a lot to be done and a lot to be conquered. Rome and the Vatican are destroyed by earthquake and by volcanic eruption. Rome descends into fiery abyss and the smoke rises. And we're to look at this in a kind of a graphic format to show what happens. Judah going forth as Christ's battle axe, Judah and Israel, into the various parts of the world. And again, this is happening as Israel is brought out, and they're all working together. But part of that bringing back out of that land results in the destruction of Babylon the Great. Is fallen. The merchants which were made rich by her shall stand far off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors, as many as trade by sea, stood afar off." The mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. In her was found the blood of the prophets, of the saints, and of all that were slain upon the earth." It was quoted from Revelations. So they are taken out, and in its place, as we said, there's nowhere that this happens but what Christ does not go and transform and purify. God's glory covers the land in those areas. Number 28, there's still a portion of the world that remains yet unconquered for Christ. portions of the world where Islam, Muslim, Hindu, countries like India, Japan, China, Africa exist, and these also are eventually subdued and converted and purified. And so the same process of action, we would suggest, takes place in relation to them also, via the medium of the armies of Israel and Judah, go into the remainder of the world and conform it, convert it to conformity with the divine purpose. And all the while this is taking place, again, the Jews are regathered and settled in their tribal allotments in the land of Israel. And this is why I'm saying this overlaps, because through this whole process, Israel and Judah are a part of it. And that's why we can't say, well, they're brought into their tribal land at this particular point. It's happening as this goes on. The temple is completed and consecrated, number 30. That also was going on, very likely, and has been suggested so, all the time of the 30-year resistance. The first Passover is celebrated. Nations begin to go to Jerusalem and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles on the newly erected temple sitting in the area of Mount Zion, Mount Moriah. And then the millennium begins. As truly as I live, God has said, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of Yahweh. That again takes us back to the why. It's the reason for this entire operation, to fill the earth with God's glory and with people who give glory to Him through the free will obedience to His requirements and try to glorify Him in that way. So to wind up, what does it mean to us? Where do we fit into this? Of what importance is all these things to us to consider? Time is running out. I think that's probably the one thing that we really have to seriously consider. Time is running out. There's nowhere to hide. We're here. We've been told what to do. And we've been told to take full opportunity and advantage of the time that we have. Redeem the time, the writers of the Old Testament told us. Certainly the message of the prophets is unequivocal. With one united voice, they warn that we stand before the God of judgment and that our misdeeds will be remembered and that the Almighty will mercilessly punish the evil and the unfaithful even as He saves the righteous. The prophets seem to say, go ahead, do what you want, do as you wish, but remember this one thing, as you do now, so will your deeds be weighed later. And if you have pandered and catered to your lower fleshly self, then beware. Peter predicted that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of His coming? It's been all these years, nothing yet. Everybody's expected Him, hasn't shown up. Where is the promise of His coming? That sentiment that's so often, if not openly suggested, certainly in the minds of many, was with the apostles in their day as well. Where's the promise of His coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, everything continues as it was. Today, this is a very common sentiment and attitude. It is up to us to make the choice that we do not fall victim to that same sentiment and attitude. We have to remember, the Bible predictors cried out in the wilderness about the first coming of Christ. We do not need so carelessly to shrug off the predictions about His second coming so thoughtlessly the second time.